Okay, so first off, thanks to the committee for the invitation, and especially thanks to you for coming. When I did that interview with the Sunday edition last year, given what's in the media and the public perception, I was expecting rather to be attacked. And instead what happened was I ended up receiving a lot of these kinds of speaking invitations from far-flung places, and was really gratified that people are interested in the nuances of the complex issue of criminal justice in this country. The Tough on Crime agenda attacks not only prisoners, but also prison staff. It attacks the families of prisoners who have to deal with these issues every day. And despite what it claims, I would argue that in many ways it ignores the real needs of victims. And so to have so many Canadians interested in engaging the complexity and better understanding what's happening has been really lovely. I'm going to start by building a little bit on some of the things Harry said about the history of chaplaincy in the federal system. I'd like to give you the context in which the changes and cuts to chaplaincy were made. And then, because I never actually worked under the privatized model, Yassine's going to talk for a few minutes about the difference it's made when we moved from the faith community model into a for-profit model. So the first thing that I wanted to explain is, as Harry alluded to, is that, in fact, prison chaplaincy has been privatized for many years. In the 1980s, there were concerns about the budget, and chaplaincy seemed like an easy win for the correctional service as a place to cut. And Pierre Allard, who was director general at the time and an amazing advocate for restorative justice, he directed this process where chaplains went back under the ownership of their faith communities. And this had some... There was good stuff and bad stuff about that. The really good stuff about it was that it reconnected the chaplains with their faith communities in a healthy way. Because they were working for their churches, there was an expectation they would go to annual church meetings, there was an expectation they would be in conversation with their denomination, and recruiting volunteers and having their denominations be an active part of the chaplaincy service was a piece of their role. That was really good. There were some difficulties with that system in that every church was reimbursed, or every faith community was reimbursed for the expense of having a chaplain in the system. And that meant that we were each working under the conditions, we were working in the physical conditions of the penitentiary, but we were working under the working conditions of our churches. So you could have two chaplains working at the same institution, doing essentially the same job with no wage parity at all, because they were paid according to the structure of their church. CSC suggested a stipend and provided the faith community with an administrative fee, but it was just a suggestion. And so some chaplains were treated very well, and others really suffered under the circumstances of their employment with their church. The statement of work or job description that chaplains had, and so this is an advantage that I see, the statement of work included that people, all chaplains, be able to serve people of all faiths, including those who identified as having no faith at all, and atheists. So we would do death notifications for virtually anybody in the institution. We certainly were available, and chaplains remain available, for conversations with anybody in the institution of any faith identification. Obviously, people would come to us for prayer and religious services, but we were not there to make people pray, and we certainly not there for purposes of conversion or pushing a particular theological agenda. So while the statement of work has for a very long time now named the chaplain as an interfaith resource, we can't say that that isn't affected by a chaplain's personal theology, right? There are some chaplains who are really good at that piece, And there are some chaplains who would struggle with that for a variety of reasons. And some churches who would struggle with that, right? There were some chaplains who would say, if my church realized I didn't try to convert the Wiccans, I'd be in serious trouble. But because I know how this works on the ground, I don't try to convert the Wiccans, and we have a good way of working forward. The other piece, and this piece was really important for me, was that the statement of work named the prophetic voice as essential to the chaplain's job description. So in some cases, chaplains saw this as something they would do internal, that they would only speak truth to power if they were talking to the warden or if they felt a prisoner or a staff person need to be called to account. But they would not exercise their prophetic voice outside of the institutional context. For me, the place of integrity with the prophetic voice was both internal and external to the institution. And I really felt that it was important that chaplains educate the general public about the way the system worked. And as Harry has noted, really importantly, engage the faith communities as much as possible in working with the families of prisoners and in reintegration support. So when I was in the system, there was one chaplain left who was an indeterminate employee of the Correctional Service of Canada, and other chaplains, the rest of us, were working under this not-for-profit contract model. It was a bit of a distraction whether we should be employees or working for our churches, but it wasn't, in my experience of it, the kind of distraction that this for-profit privatization process seems to have come to be. So there are two things that I think were essential that the contracting model made room for in terms of expressions of pastoral care. And the first was this idea that faiths other than Christian in the first, there were contracts for pastoral care providers from faiths other than Christian if the population and the system warranted that, and a credentialed provider could be found. And in a city like Kingston, where we have this huge number of prisons, most people only think of Kingston Penn, but in fact in Kingston at one point there were 10 federal institutions, now there are 6, and a huge number of prisoners, many of whom are from the Greater Toronto Area, and so quite a religiously diverse population in the prison system, but not a religiously diverse population in the city of Kingston itself. And this has been a challenge in both models, to find people who can who are geographically accessible and can provide pastoral care across religious identifications. And in the old model, there was a lot more room, it seemed, for part-time contracts that would cover the expenses of people to travel from afar to minister to the smaller faith groups in the institutions. This was really important. And as Yassine has noted in his recent media interviews, healthy, long-standing relationships between moderate religious officials of any faith and vulnerable people like prisoners can prevent or correct theological distortions. This is true right across the religious spectrum. It doesn't matter what your identification it is. It is just as important that moderate Christian pastors be in the system to combat theological distortions as it is any other denomination. And I'd like to give you an example through the tradition of Wicca. When I was a student at the Regional Treatment Center, which is a psychiatric facility for federally sentenced offenders, there was a deaf Wiccan prisoner in the system. So I was the only person in the institution at that time who had any fluency in sign language, which was this person's first language. And so the prisoner was pretty happy to visit with me on a weekly basis. I believe that God speaks to us all in whatever way we can hear. And so I had no theological problem supporting the man to work with his tarot cards, even though tarot is largely outside my experience. Mostly I was glad to be with this guy, because you can imagine how isolated a deaf man would be in prison and what kind of paranoid theology he could develop under those circumstances. In order to better support him, I consulted with the Wiccan chaplain who was on contract at the time. And she explained to me that prisoners in that particular institution often got into Wicca because they mistakenly thought that divination with the tarot would give them better control over potential victims. Then she explained that she used the tarot to show the men how to gain greater self-control, that the cards would identify to them the areas of their life that needed work, and then they could direct their healing energy and attention to correcting those parts of their inner life that needed that attention and the cards had identified for them. This is not unlike when a Christian man uses the words of the Apostle Paul to justify beating his wife. But a healthy pastor will then direct that man to the places in Scripture that talk about mercy and respect, as well as the first commandment that tells us to love self and others. The old system, the faith community model, was not perfect at screening out people with unacceptable theological positions, either in chaplains or volunteers. Any system's going to have its flaws. But by and large, there had been a greater move towards professionalization that had been very helpful. In fact, for a time, there was a specialized training program at the Queen's School of Religion in restorative justice that was well attended by chaplains. It did not become independently financially sustainable, and CSC canceled its financial support of that program about 5 years ago. But overall, most of us were highly trained, and the professionalization and the kind of theology that was compatible with interfaith care was definitely a priority. Vic Taves had no understanding of the vetting process or the purpose of chaplaincy when he made the decision to cancel the part-time contracts. It seems, by all evidence, to have been purely in reaction to a theological concern. And what he really needed to have thought about was how having properly vetted chaplains in the system allows a moderate religious narrative to be presented to those whose circumstances and background may make them vulnerable to poor theology. And it also gives a structure that prevents antisocial leadership rising up in the religious milieu of the institution. Excuse me. When Erwin Kotler was here in the fall, he talked about the government's responsibility to create legislation and policies that prevented a charter challenge. And this was definitely a decision that the government made without understanding the human rights implications under the charter. So Vic Taves' decision to cancel these contracts really made room for a lot of charter challenges, which have begun and were halted to see how the privatization model would work out. And then, as Harry noted, another very important aspect of the previous contract model was the provision of community chaplaincy. Most of those contracts were part-time, and so there was no mechanism under the new system to have community chaplaincy funded the way it had been. And this has been huge. I was really happy to learn on Friday that that there is a request for proposals going forward to refund community chaplaincy, and I'm just really interested to find out more about that and see how it goes. But what the public needs to know about that is that community chaplaincy has huge implications for whether or not somebody is likely to reoffend. It can make all the difference in the world. Circles of Support and Accountability, which works with high-risk sex offenders, has a phenomenal track record. And community chaplaincy with people who have a variety of kinds of offending histories has been shown to be very, very effective. So this is really, it's really important that this be reestablished somehow. So as I said, when I was originally invited to speak here, Jim Black and I had talked about sort of addressing the overall tough on crime agenda and the difference that this has made to programming in the institutions. And so I do want to give you the kind of wider context of all of this. For decades now in Canada, we've had the Corrections and Conditional Release Act, and That piece of legislation actually made Canada a progressive on the world stage. So even though there were lots of problems with that system, obviously Indigenous people, people with mental health, and people of impoverished backgrounds are hugely overrepresented in prisons, as are people with histories of victimization, we still were seen on the world stage as a progressive. And all of these policies that were in place under the CCRA were evidence-based policies. Our parole system, discretionary sentencing, and even the relatively pleasant living conditions of some of our minimum security facilities were evidence-based. And there was a reason for the club fed that has been so disparaged in the media. It helped to make people better or at least keep them from getting worse. And this was a really good thing. The problem was twofold. One, while the officials were counting successes, only the failures make the news, and the public were counting the headlines. Two, a lot of effort is put into dealing with offenders, but the government had never given equivalent thought to providing proper care for victims. And of course, that created a lot of resentment in the victim population, which is quite understandable. And so this combination created a situation which has been easy for the Cruff on Time crew to capitalize on. Alterations to the parole and sentencing, the cancellation of the prison farm programs, which received a lot of attention in Kingston, but not the attention it deserves across the country, and crowding are all issues that have had a fair bit of attention. An issue that has not made the news but had significant impact on the population I worked with at Pittsburgh was the cancellation of the low-intensity sex offender programming. So, how am I doing? I'm okay. This is something that I think the public really needs to know about. Treatment for low-risk sex offenders was canceled across the country and never made the news. And a lot of the victims of those types of offenses, their primary concern is that this offender receive treatment and not do this ever again, right? So it was research-based in a way. There was research that said that if you over-programmed somebody, they needed moderate intensity treatment and you gave them high intensity treatment, you would in fact raise their risk. And so the government used that research to say, let's just cancel all the low-intensity programming for every kind of offense. What they didn't do was look at the research which said sex offenders had different needs than the rest of the population. And they claimed that the parole board was in support of this decision, but in fact the parole board is not. So now all of these men who have been refused treatment, the government simply is not offering it, are also denied parole because the parole board is unwilling to release untreated sex offenders. And the problem for that is twofold. Yes, exactly. the problem for that is twofold. One is that we know the longer we keep people in jail, the higher their risk to reoffend. Also, most of the low-intensity guys are people who offended within their own families. It takes a long time for these children to get old enough to have the courage to press the charges. It takes a long time for that to go through the system. And you have men coming in. The oldest guy to come into Pittsburgh when I was there was 88 years old. And so you have very elderly and often physically infirm men serving sentences. They can't receive the programming they need inside, and they're not being released because they're considered too high risk. And so you guys are paying for them to live in the institution, for them to be carried into town for their medical treatment, for all kinds of things that could be much more economically better handled in the community. And in many cases, I have a lot of question about the risk. The one guy died just a couple of weeks after he was turned down by the parole board, and he had a palliative diagnosis at the time. It was not an uncommon situation for men with palliative diagnosis with high care needs to be kept in because they were too high risk as untreated sex offenders. And it's easy for them to do that because the general public does not have enough understanding of the effectiveness of the programming, what the research tells us about reoffending rates for various crimes, and they are especially ignorant about the amount of success that our federal system has had in reducing further offending. So as I say, the officials have counted the successes, but the public counts the headlines. And the government has capitalized on all of that ignorance to implement all kinds of policies, including the changes to chaplaincy. To my own peril, when the decision about cutting chaplaincy was announced, I spent far too much time monitoring the response on the blogs and the news sites, and the assumptions and the ignorance were quite appalling. The facts are that chaplaincy makes a significant difference, not just to human dignity inside the institutions, but also to community safety. The research has told us time and again that having something to lose is essential to the desistance of crime, and that in most cases, the most effective something to lose is a relationship. Studies have shown that prisoners that are visited regularly during their sentence, interestingly by anyone other than a former spouse, have much lower reoffending rates than those who serve their sentences in isolation. And oftentimes, when a prisoner is isolated, it's the chaplain and the volunteers who come in through the chaplain who reduce that isolation. A quick Google search the other day gave me four studies that identify between a 40 and 50% reduction in recidivism or reoffending rates when a person is visited regularly during their sentence, has some kind of mentorship during their sentence. And again, it's primarily chaplains and chaplaincy programming who provide that 40 to 50% reduction in reoffending. So the continuum of care from institutional to community chaplaincy has been integral in that kind of support and obviously should be bolstered rather than thrown into the kind of distraction we've experienced in the last couple of years. I want to leave some time for Yassine, but I also want to tell you why I left. I left, as I said, before the private contractor was named. There was one company that had was responding to the request for proposals that was using what I saw as highly unethical tactics to beef up their bids. They were advertising jobs that didn't exist. I didn't think I wanted to work for them. They didn't win the contract in the end, thank heavens. I was also concerned about the theological position of the contract winner, and finally that the new circumstances would not allow me to exercise my particular sense of vocation in terms of the prophetic voice. And I was offered my current position before the dust settled on the contracting process. I did have some hope that the new company would have the power to better the working conditions of chaplains who had not been treated well by their faith communities. We can safely say that for the most part, institutional chaplains have seen the creation of wage equity. For some, this has been an improvement in their prior circumstances, and others have chosen to stay at great financial loss. My greatest concern about the new arrangement is that the same budget, although the numbers you gave are much bigger than the original budget, so that I should look at that more. In any case, the budget is now, whatever it is now paying for two layers of management. So all of the CSC managers have stayed in place, and now there's a layer of management in the private company. And I feel awful saying this because all of these people are my friends or former colleagues, and I don't want any of them to lose their job. But as a taxpayer and as a person who's really concerned about the majority of dollars being spent on frontline services, that just gives me a stop in my mind. And then the other concern that remains with me is the provision of religion-specific pastoral care outside of the Christian denominations. As I said, this has always been a challenge, but it seems to me an even greater challenge under the new system. And so with that, I will hand it over to Yassine to speak about his experience.
Good afternoon. In the name of God, most gracious and most merciful, I greet you all with the greeting words of peace. We say in the religion of Islam, Assalamu alaikum. Peace be with you. I'm very happy to be here and very honored to share the stage with my dear sister Kate and to join you, this blessed congregation here this afternoon. I feel honored and I also feel humbled to be at church. And when I mentioned to my parents that I was going to church, the first thing they said is, make sure your shoes are very shiny. So I did as best as I could, but I had a very complicated walk today, so perhaps they aren't up to standard. But I got a very interesting call yesterday from an uncle in Jamaica. My mother and father are from Jamaica, and my extended family are from Jamaica. And I had a very, a disturbing call that my uncle was the victim of a robbery at gunpoint. And he was pistol whipped, and some jewelry was taken, and some identification was taken. And I was quite upset. My mother was especially upset. This was her brother. And we spoke with him about what happened, and he said to us in patois, not the Rob Ford type, but he said to us, "Riena fall but doti tough," which means the rain is falling, the blessings come, but the ground remains hard. The life, the grind, the hustle of life remains tough. And I began reflecting on that and reflecting on what had happened to my uncle, and I realized that we live in a very safe country. Canada is a very safe country, regardless of what we may hear from certain circles of government. We live in a very safe country. And the tough on crime agenda really acts as a political football that is tossed back and forth by certain people who may use that for rhetorical purposes, perhaps to play on the fear of people to get elected. And that's something we have to really, really keep in mind when we discuss the issue of the tough on crime agenda. Also, I was at a program last night called the One Love Chaplaincy Fundraising Dinner, put on and sponsored by the Islam Care Center based in Ottawa, which acted as the sole contractor for Islamic chaplaincy services in the Ontario region. It was a wonderful program, and it gathered a lot of former chaplains, and many members of the Muslim community to celebrate the achievements of chaplaincy in the Muslim community, and also to raise awareness of what chaplaincy actually is. Because for very long, the default chaplains have always been either Protestant or Catholic, and as Muslims, we are the Johnny-come-latelys, or the Ahmed-come-latelys into the whole chaplaincy profession. So we celebrated this, and one of the former Muslim inmates that we worked with gave a very, very brief presentation, and he reminded everyone about the importance of intention. And in Islamic scripture, you may find very consistent reminders of intention, that indeed all deeds are judged by the intention. And since I am in a house of worship, a house of God, perhaps you would permit me to use a story, a parable, to perhaps emphasize how important this is, because intention really is everything, and we gain what we intend. We are rewarded based on what we intend. And there was this man who was known for his piety. He discovered that the people of his village had begun worshiping a tree. And as a person who believed in the unicity of God, the oneness of God, he decided that he was going to cut down this tree, this created object that his people were worshiping beside the Creator. So he decided to go and chop down the tree. And along the way, he met a man. And this man asked him, "What are you doing? Where are you going?" And the pious man said, "I'm going to chop down this tree." And the stranger said, "No, I can't let you do that." So the pious man said, no, I have to chop this down because my people have taken it as an idol. And the first commandment indeed is to worship one God. So the stranger said, "No, I can't let you do that." So the pious man said, "Yes, I'm going to chop it down." The stranger said, no, you can't do that." So they began to fight. They began to battle. Tyson Holyfield time, right? They're fighting back and forth. But the pious man subdued the stranger until the stranger said, "Please, let's make a deal." And so the pious man, being someone who gives everyone the benefit of the doubt, he said, "Okay, what is your proposal?" And the stranger said, "My proposal is this, that I will give you silver coins. I will give you silver coins every day for the rest of your life. Think of all the good that you can do with those silver coins. You can feed the hungry, help the poor, the destitute, the needy. I will give you these silver coins every day for the rest of your life. Just don't chop down that tree." So the pious man said, "It's a deal." So he went back home, woke up the next morning, and he saw the silver coins, and he went and he spent it on the poor, the destitute, the needy, the marginalized. Went back home, woke up the next morning, again he saw the silver coins. And he went out and spent it on the poor, the destitute, the needy, doing all of this good for the marginalized in his society. And this went on for a very, very long time until he woke up one morning, he opened his door, he didn't see the silver coin. So he went back and got his knife, or as we say in Jamaica, his machete, and he began sharpening his machete, and he went out to chop down the tree. And along the way, who does he meet? A stranger. And the stranger asked him, "Where are you going?" Pious man said, "No, none of that. Get out of my way. I'm going to chop down this tree." And the stranger said, "No, I'm not going to let you chop down this tree." The pious man said, "No, we've been through this already. I'm going to chop down the tree." "No, you're not." "Yes, I am." "No, you're not." They begin to fight again. Tyson Holyfield too. They're fighting back and forth, going back and forth. But this time, the stranger subdues the pious man. So as the stranger is about to finish off the pious man says, "How is this? Yesterday, I defeated you, but today, you defeated me." And the stranger looked at him with contempt and said, "Yesterday, before, you battled me with the intention of pleasing God. But today, you're battling me for the silver coins." So my remarks at the beginning is we need to make sure that our intentions are quite clear, that our intentions are focused on that prophetic voice, as my sister Kate mentioned, because this work is a prophetic work, that chaplains are indeed hires of the prophets and messengers. So with that, I'm going to read a prepared statement and presentation. And I hope that, God willing, that perhaps afterwards we'll be able to have some very good discussion, perhaps some animated discussion, but I deeply look forward to that. While reflecting on the tragic events in Paris last week, I was troubled to learn that the terrorists were former inmates who were radicalized while incarcerated. This is important, or an important lesson for those of us in Canada who have witnessed the unintended consequences of the federal government's attempts at saving a few dollars at the expense of professional and accountable spiritual care. Responsive spiritual care would offer the best antidote to the phenomenon of prison radicalization. Unfortunately, the federal government has undermined these efforts, seriously putting into question its ability to address radicalization towards extremist violence in a holistic way. Offenders from diverse faith communities do not always have access to chaplains and religious caregivers. They can be at a disadvantage if they want the opportunity to access those religious tools necessary for an authentic and balanced understanding of religion and spirituality in the context of prison. Until 2013, the Correctional Service of Canada partnered with a diverse group of faith communities to provide religious and spiritual services in Canadian federal prisons. During that period, Canadians witnessed the best of our multi-faith religious organizations providing professional chaplaincy care to correctional staff and a diverse inmate population, working diligently to emphasize the important role of spirituality in the journey to healing, reformation, and spiritual completeness. Despite the lack of any evidence that a change was necessary, then Public Safety Minister Vic Taves issued an edict, or as we say in the Muslim community, a fatwa, effectively destroying this successful partnership and ordering the privatization of chaplaincy services in Canadian federal prisons. A company calling itself Kairos Numa Chaplaincy Incorporated, formed solely to compete for the private contract, was awarded a multi-million dollar mandate to provide chaplaincy services in our federal correctional facilities. With one reckless swipe of the pen, experienced religious institutions representing a diverse Canadian spiritual mosaic gave way to a profit-based company whose bottom line was possibly and potentially lining its pockets with the proverbial 30 pieces of silver. Tragically, the moral dimension of chaplaincy and the meaningful spiritual contribution to the correctional project was eliminated. This radical transformation has brought about a series of liabilities that have negatively impacted upon public safety. It is safe to assume that the Harper government views commercial interests, which align with particular social services, to be more efficient, though evidence suggests otherwise. Those partnerships often make systems more resistant to change and creativity. In the field of corrections, creativity and flexibility are essential for producing real and lasting results. Just an aside, I met one offender quite some time ago who was segregated. And this individual was looking for a halal diet. A halal diet is analogous to a kosher diet. It's a religiously approved diet for Muslims called halal. So he wanted a halal diet, but I noticed that on his personal information chart, he was registered as a Rastafarian. So I was the Muslim chaplain to issue a halal, and I also happened to be black, well, more of a warm cocoa color. So they asked me, I was the default authority for this person. So I went to segregation to meet this individual. And I said, well, it looks like, okay, you want a halal diet, but you're registered as a Rastafarian. In fact, he looked identifiably Rastafarian. And I asked him, well, you know, you want a halal diet, you're clearly Rastafarian, so what's up? What's happening? He said, well, I'm a Muslim and I'm a Rasta too. I said, so that means you're a Muslifarian. He said, yeah, man. So he is, yes. So he was a Muslifarian, but ultimately when it comes to creativity, chaplains oftentimes are at the forefront of trying to, you know, be creative with spirituality and find meaning in that perhaps which is not understandable on the surface, but rather with the sixth sense that a chaplain possesses, we can extract meaning from their particular spiritual or religious experience. So in the field of corrections, creativity and flexibility are essential for producing real and lasting results. Therefore, the manipulation of such services in the name of ideology can be potentially dangerous, especially when public safety is the primary concern. For me, these moral dilemmas forced me to resign, but not necessarily quit, as a matter of principle from my position as Canada's only full-time Muslim prison chaplain. In the Canadian case, we must be tough on crime. However, at the same time, we must also be tough on the causes of crime. Community-supported chaplains have always been in the best position to manage and provide a reasonable balance. During my time as a federal prison chaplain, I ministered to a wide variety of offenders. Among them were individuals convicted of terrorist-related offenses. Though no formal government support was provided for counter-radicalization programming, we took the lead in creating a manageable program as a matter of moral responsibility. The present privatized model does not require, from the Islamic point of view, professional accountability. Without Islamic community oversight and clearly outlined professional clerical standards, these kind of irresponsible scenarios will be repeated and will potentially put the Canadian public at risk. Also, in light of the public concern about religious radicalization, should we not take direct responsibility rather than leaving it to unqualified groups and individuals whose primary motivation may be monetary? Why are we reinventing the chaplaincy wheel? Chaplains teach offenders to be mindful of temptations, to remain far apart from nefarious activities, and to take full responsibility for their actions. As citizens, our duty is to speak out against the ideological attacks on the programs that truly help Canada be safe. Brothers and sisters and friends, I had one conversation with an individual yesterday that will remain nameless, but we spoke about the issue of neutrality. We spoke about the issue of neutrality. This word neutrality is often thrown about when it comes to very, very difficult questions or questions that may impact specific communities greatly. We want to remain neutral. And we use this word as if this word is really a principled word, but it's not, in my humble opinion. And just as an aside, this is only my opinion. You know, my attitude is I am correct with the possibility of being wrong, and my opponent is wrong with the possibility of being correct. So I stand to be corrected in anything that I say. However, this idea of neutrality is not a nice word when it comes to very serious issues as this. Neutrality means that you accept the status quo. Neutrality means you accept the status quo. But when it comes to certain issues as this that really target the marginalized, the destitute, the needy, the poor, then there's no room for neutrality. We have to take a firm stand, and then if our intention is indeed to please the one, to please our Creator, then indeed we will be rewarded generously in this life and, God willing, in the hereafter. So with that, I leave you. Thank you very much for offering me this opportunity. I leave you with peace. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be with you.